This is the podcast of the Germanic American Institute.
Welcome.
Willkommen.
Where Germanic-speaking European countries...
Germany.
Deutschland.
Austria.
Österreich.
Switzerland.
Schweiz.
Blend with the Midwestern United States.
Hallo. Hallo.
Servus.
Grüezi.
We are here and there, and we invite you to come along on the journey. Welcome back to another episode of Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute. This is Günther hosting. Once again, we are taking you down a conversational interview path. And to do so, I have my sidekick with me, Erin. Erin, welcome to the podcast once again.
Thank you.
And Erin is actually introducing our guest.
Excellent. Well, I'm so delighted to welcome the Consul General in Chicago, Wolfgang Mersinger, who is visiting us in the Twin Cities this week. He's been very busy, and we're very excited that he's here with us today. Consul General Mersinger has a long career in the German diplomatic service, including postings in, now this will test my knowledge of foreign capitals, Dakar, Senegal, Helsinki, Finland, Moscow, Edinburgh, Baku, and most recently in Chicago, starting in 2019. So, Consul General Mersinger, welcome to our podcast. Welcome to the Germanic American Institute.
Thank you for having me.
Allow me to start with the first question. How does one actually become a Consul General?
A consul general post is a post in the diplomatic service that is either in a consulate general or is the head of a consular department in a bigger embassy. So it's actually an ordinary post within the foreign service. It's not a special career within the foreign service. So you could end up a consul general, you could end up an ambassador, you could end up just a diplomat in an embassy. All is possible, all depends on the posting that the personal department of the Foreign Office chooses for you, or to be more precise, for which you apply on the list of vacancies that is published every year, and you can then apply for certain posts.
So the general representation out of Germany, which is located in Washington, D.C. with its main embassy, where do you fall in that, let's call it hierarchy, perhaps would be a good word to use?
I mean, in the United States, it's pretty clear that the embassy in Washington is, of course, the most important representation of Germany. There is the ambassador, there is the whole array of departments, cultural, economical, political, consular, of course. In some countries, it's sometimes not so clear when in other countries, the big cities like in Brazil, Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo sometimes outweigh Brasilia. But still, of course, the ambassador is in the capital with many of his staff. But he is quite clear that Washington is by far the most important and also the biggest representation we have. And there are six or seven, I should count them, the consulates general in the country. There's one in Atlanta, in Boston, in New York, in Chicago, in Houston, and San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Seven.
And of course, the embassy in Washington itself has a consular district. So when it comes to consular matters, the United States is divided into these districts so that people do not have to travel too far, for example, for applying for passports or people who need visas to apply for visas. If I take away that the guys in San Francisco have to cover Alaska, we are certainly the biggest consular district in the mainland 48 states, covering from North Dakota to Kentucky, six times the territory of Germany and about 70 million people. 20 million of whom are or claim German descent.
Right.
That's actually quite the number. As opposed to the Austrian consulate, which in Chicago has only very small footprint presence, and even that only, I think, once or twice a year anymore. The German presence in Chicago is steady, or are you there seasonally?
No, we are there steadily. I mean, the consulate general in Austria is an honorary consulate general, like Barbara Müller here in Minneapolis. On top of it, they have a trade office, which is a particularity of Austria, that they have specific trade offices where they have particular trade interests. In the German system, trade offices are not common, because we have our German international chambers of commerce. We have decided that it's better for the businesses to organize themselves in the kind of similar of the German chamber system, which makes it a little bit more free for them to choose. But on the other hand, to avail yourself of all their services, you should become a member. That would make many things easier. But of course, we look after the interests of German businesses as well, especially if the chamber reports to us that there are certain problems that can only be solved on a political level. But the Chamber of Commerce in Chicago has, I think, 5 times more personnel than the Consulate General.
Oh, wow, okay.
which shows how thriving the German-American business relations are in the Midwest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we are right, we are 20 people in the Consulate General in Chicago. We are permanent there. And half of these of the colleagues there work in the consular section, issuing passports, visas, doing all kinds of consular support that people expect in Germany, going to their Rathaus or to a notary, depending on which type of service they need. And that's why we are so everywhere in the country. We try to be in many places in order to make it easy for people to reach us and not to travel too far. Although, of course, somebody needs to travel from North Dakota to Chicago. That's quite a journey. But passport applications, for example, and some other consular services can be applied for with the honorary consul here in Minneapolis. We have 6 in our area: Minneapolis, Des Moines, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Kansas City. So 7.
Oh, okay, there you go.
There is the lucky 7 seems to be going around.
Yeah.
And I would argue for most North Dakotans, going to Chicago is a welcome break in the monotony and qualifies for some level of vacation.
I can't possibly comment on that.
So. I've lived in Fargo for 10 years. I'll cover that.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you. That was really helpful to hear that overview. I had a personal question for you. Mm-hmm. So what led you to join the Foreign Service or the Diplomatic Service?
Well, I'm in so far not a typical diplomat, because most of my colleagues are either lawyers or economists. I studied German, French, and history to become a K-12 school teacher. And after I've done that and I passed my first, as we say in German, Staatsexamen, examination, then the Ministry for Culture in Baden-Württemberg told me, we have no post for you. We don't take any more young teachers. We have too many. Anyway, if you had studied arts or some sciences, maybe, but German, French history, we don't need you really. So what do you do with the state's exam and not having a job, but having lived abroad in France for a year, having studied languages, history? I looked around what are the alternatives, and then one of the alternatives is applying for the Foreign Office. The Goethe Institute was the other alternative, and of course some foundations and other organizations with an international footprint. And I was lucky enough that the Foreign Office has a very complicated and long recruitment process. Takes over almost a year to finish it, with various stages in between. And so I just jumped from one stage to the other. always being re-invited to come back. And so at the end of the day, they took the chance in taking me on. And that was in 1987.
Okay. Wow, that's funny how life works out like that.
I wouldn't say a desperate move. It was more a logical continuation of what I did. And because the plan A didn't work, then I had a plan B. I know many of my other colleagues, they have really already started in the university to look out what they need to do to get well prepared for the recruitment process, and to really eye to get into the Foreign Office from very early stage on. But that can be dangerous, because if you fail twice in that process, you can't reapply. You can reapply once, but not after the second refusal, and then you have put all your eggs in one basket and it doesn't hatch. That's not a good thing.
To get to your position, there aren't that many people in such positions, so it's the air up there is pretty thin. But my head goes toward, do you have to work yourself up the ladder, so to speak, to get into this position, or is joining the foreign ministry enough to then be appointed? What is the process like upon entry into that type of duty?
Yeah, it's like many big organizations. You're with experience and you prove yourself, and they are happy with you and or not happy, depending, of course. But after a couple of years, they trust you and they put you in some of these leadership positions when you run, as we say, a small mission, Auslandsvertretung, a foreign mission. Big or small, I mean, the embassy in Washington, of course, is much, much bigger. And to get to that level, you have to be even much more in the eye of the minister. I mean, ambassadorial positions are actually appointed in cabinet. So that is something that the minister alone cannot do, although he will suggest and propose, but it needs cabinet approval. For consuls general, that's not so complicated. So the personnel department reviews the applications and then decides who is the best person for that post or that post. And as I said, every year we get in September or August, around this time of the year, you get a list of vacancies for the next summer. And this list is, of course, in different departments. I mean, either in headquarters or abroad, and then different levels. And then you choose what you want to do next, because one thing is for sure in our life, we change every 4 years, more roughly, maybe sometimes three, sometimes five, but basically every 4 years. So you know when your term comes to an end, and you choose then where you want to go next. Because the only thing that you can't choose is to stay forever where you are. Which is, many people ask us, is that not, do we not lose experience? Do we not lose knowledge when we change every 4 years? Yes, we do. That is the disadvantage of that system. But if we don't, it would probably be much unfairer system. Imagine you are posted to Baghdad.
I was, incidentally. I used to be a foreign service officer.
You know, but I mean, be there for 4 years or even longer, it's probably very hard. And somebody else has the luck to be posted to Paris and can stay there forever. That's somehow not a fair distribution of duties. Mm-hmm. So that's the one reason why it needs to change. And the other reason is that we do not go too native. Because you develop, of course, personal relationship in your post. You get to know people, usually nice people, and you want to help them. We always have this problem that we sometimes develop into being the representative of our host country to Germany and not the other way around. And to avoid that, it's also good to change every 3 to 4 years so that you're not getting too local and too much, how to say, ingrained into the local community.
You did mention the Bundesminister that approves certain positions. Are you under any political pressure in this position?
We do not. We have very, very few political appointees in the Foreign Office. I mean, it can appear that the Chancellor has somebody in her view or his view whom he wants to appoint an ambassador here or there, who is not a member of the Foreign Service. That happens occasionally, or a new minister brings in new staff in his personal office, minister's office, and even if the minister leaves, they stay because they like it with us. And then they can get also positions in the diplomatic service, either at the headquarters or abroad. But I would say this is, if it's a lot, then if it's probably two or three dozens in the whole service of 7,000 people. So it's a minor share, but it can happen, but it's rare. And on the position of consuls general, it's rather unusual that you have political appointees there. And once they are part of our network, of our group, then after a couple of years, you won't notice very much anymore that they have not been through our training, through our school, and through our kind of worked up the ladder in our hierarchy. They might have worked it up somewhere else before.
In your different postings that you've had, what would you say has been your most challenging post or your most rewarding post?
Yeah, in the list you mentioned in the beginning, you forgot one. One previously before Chicago was in Ukraine, eastern Ukraine.
Oh, that's right.
In Dnipropetrovsk, that's a city that nobody knows, although it has 1 million people. It is on the Dnieper River in eastern Ukraine, about 220 kilometers west from what they call now euphemistically the contact line, which is basically the front line between Ukrainian government troops and the troops of these Russian-backed rebels, separatists. We had a consulate previously in Donetsk, and of course with all the trouble there, they had to be evacuated. And then the ministry decided we want to keep a consulate in eastern Ukraine and just relocate it a little bit further west, and there was then Dnipropetrovsk was basically the nearest possible town. It's a very industrial town, has a lot of steel and still coal and power stations and so on. But it's a typically Ukrainian town. And from there, we worked hard to support our humanitarian effort to relieve the suffering for the people who lived under this horrendous conditions of the war, because that's what it is in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly challenging and rewarding at the same time, because you could see that we made a difference. We are the second biggest donor, mm-hmm. in some respects even the biggest donor to Ukraine. It sometimes gets forgotten in this Nord Stream 2 debate here in the country that as if we haven't done anything for Ukraine. That sometimes I feel that sometimes personally insulting to say that, because I devoted 4 of my years to do that. So that was very, very good, because it was not only the humanitarian effort, we also supported Ukrainians, many Ukrainian and NGOs and so civil organizations in transforming a post-Soviet state into a democracy, and to help Ukraine to define themselves as a Western-style democracy. The interesting thing is, I think, that, and what Putin really misread, is that he thought that there are so many people in Ukraine that are pro-Russian that he simply has to offer them, and then they will come to him and Ukraine will collapse. And the complete opposite happened. The Ukrainians had always a bit trouble to find a common identity, because the country is has been coupled together from various traditions. In the West, it's Catholic, Polish. South, it's more Romanian. Then parts are Cossack, the real old Cossack tradition, and then around Kiev is the core of the Ukrainian nation. So they had a bit of trouble. What unites us? What are we, Ukraine as Ukrainians? And thanks to Putin, they know now, they might not still know what they are, but they know one thing, that they are not. They are not Russians. And that is something that is completely misunderstood and misread by Putin. And we helped also to develop the positive identity as being a democracy in the making. And it was encouraging to see so many young people really taking it on, starting campaigns against corruption, for women's rights, for the environment, all kinds of things. As we know it in our countries, what people get engaged into. They did the same, but under much more difficult conditions, and of course, without any charity, local charities that support this kind of efforts. You know, there are no big foundations who give away millions here and there for all kinds of activities. So that's something where the donor community came in. And Germany was, in that respect, probably really the biggest donor, together with the European Union, but 27% of what the union does is our money as well.
You mentioned misreading and identity. And undoubtedly, we can say that the United States have been through what I would describe as four rather turbulent, perhaps interesting years. I suppose the turbulence has changed here in the last 6 months, but I'm also wondering whether the representation as quasi the go-between between Germany proper and the United States has influenced you in terms of the different administration, previously Trump, now Biden. Has it changed for you?
It has changed for us to a lower degree than for the embassy in Washington. Because even in the most turbulent times, as you call it, on the local level, on the level of businesses, not much had changed. Because people who love Germany didn't simply stop loving Germany because there is a president who doesn't. Mm-hmm. Or businesses who worked together for decades didn't simply stop to work together. Of course, they had additional problems because of all the tariffs and all the trade issues, but all the more they worked together. Sister cities continued to work. Schools continued to exchange students. So that's why for us, and I think the other consulates general, and most of them as well, did not have this big of a problem. But of course, on the political level, which is covered by the embassy, they had four very difficult times. Because everything that went previously rather smoothly, you know, phone call, the Department of State, what's your position to this or that? Or can we just see whether we can have a common position? Or phone call to the Department of Pentagon or to the Department of Trade, and things got somehow clarified easily. But under Trump, that these phone calls couldn't happen anymore because on the other side nobody picked up the phone. Or if, then they didn't say anything. And if they picked it up and said something, they said, we don't know either which direction is going. I mean, literally, there were people in the Department of State who urged the embassy not to phone before 11 a.m. because that's the time they need to make sense of the tweets that came out overnight.
Wow. Yeah.
That's got to be an incredibly difficult position to be in.
Of course, because 11 o'clock is already 6 o'clock in Germany,
right.
So they were waiting a whole day to get answers to certain questions. And because every day some new surprises came out of the tweets, it was very difficult. And of course, this is probably joking, but the most difficult thing is that we did not know whether or not we can find common positions to very, very important issues. I mean, global issues, starting from security issues to climate, to trade, to all kinds of things. And that was particularly difficult for the embassy colleagues because that put them into a very bad spot. On the one hand, expectations from Berlin, And on the other hand, not being able to fulfill these expectations because the other side wasn't cooperative anymore. For us, it was not so difficult because we continued with our partners here, and most of the partners were of the same opinion that they do not understand what comes out of the White House and don't approve of what came out of the White House. So, of course, some people were careful because they were in positions where they had to be loyal. But I have never met anybody who approved 100% of the policies that came out of the White House. Never, ever. And to be, let's say, a bit more cautious, we, of course, there is a new dynamic, but we are still very worried in Germany that this is a temporary fix, because the underlying threat to democracy and to reasonable government is not gone. I mean, you see what happened on the 6th of January and how little the GOP has an interest in finding out what really happened. And how little there is readiness to accept the result of the elections, and how strong the movement still is that actually challenges everything. There is no guarantee whatsoever that this cannot come back at the next election, 24, maybe even already in 22 when majorities change in Congress. And then we are again in a similar situation again. And that's what worries us, that we, and that has left really a mark in the conscience of many people in Europe, that we cannot rely anymore 100% on America being a trustworthy partner. And that's very dangerous.
How do you see the upcoming elections in Germany affecting the relationship?
We have come to a consensus in Germany now, I think, that there's hardly any question about how important it is to have a stable transatlantic relation. I mean, first of all, we are embedded into Europe. We have made it our state philosophy now that we do not do anything that is not in accordance with the European interest. And that's why we want Europe and United States being really in close partnership. We have different opinions, that's normal. Sometimes also different focus on what's more important for us. But and I think this is now a consensus. That mean we might have changes in policies after the elections, yes. But that's what elections are for. But in the issue of German-American or European-American relations, there is not a big difference between the major parties in Germany.
Okay.
Would you, I'm going to try to phrase this carefully, would you consider the equal balance within the trade partners, such as the European Union, in conjunction with the U.S. or in collaboration with the U.S., has it changed its dynamic and its power due to Brexit?
Due to Brexit? A little, but not very much, because I think EU and U.S. still remain by far the biggest trading partners in the world. I mean, I don't have the figures in my head, but I think it's about a third or half of all trade in the world is done between these two blocks. And I mean, everybody talks about China. Yes, China is important, but either of us trades much, much more with the other partner than with China. And that's why it was so detrimental that we started to, to call each other the enemies. I mean, not we, but the other side did. Driving a German car was suddenly a danger to national security and things like that. That made us, that was a real hard thing for us, because we are united in the view with the United States that China is a challenge. course, there are different approaches and different dependencies. We depend on China more than the United States, as we depend more on Russia than the United States. That's why United States can always be kind of very, very principled, because it costs them less than us. But in the overall picture, we agree that we have to do something to kind of hedge China to a certain extent. And I think the best thing we can do that is if we stand together, if we try to come up with standards, norms, rules, regulations for the international order, if we together suggest or propose regulations, for example, for internet or for taxes for these big global companies or for cybersecurity or anything like that, if America and Europe are united in that, the rest of the world, at least the rest of the free world, I think will follow. But already at that level, we start fighting each other then, putting other countries in the bad position to choose either the American or the European point of view. That's exactly what China wants, and that's exactly what Russia wants. Mm-hmm. That's why I always say those people who have put this wedge between us, they do, whether they like it or not, and whether they do it intentionally or not, but they do China's and Russia's job. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That has to be clear. And now Brexit, of course, the United Kingdom was a very important part of the United of Europe, especially also in the trade and in trade policies, because we had a very similar view on many trade policies, like the UK. But if you look at the figures, it doesn't make such a big difference for us or for America. I think it's much more an issue for the United Kingdom itself, and I think they have to reinvent themselves to a certain extent, because I think they overstate their importance by thinking they can kind of be somewhere in between and being the bridge or so. I don't think that American companies are very willing to, when they look at Europe, to start looking at two different sets of rules, or that they want to have two different approaches to certain issues. And when it then comes to whether or not they follow European or British issues or rules, you can guess which one is more interesting for them, because where's the bigger market?
Right. Yeah. From a distribution sense, it's almost is logical that the UK almost outcast itself by voting for Brexit.
That's what we always said, and nobody listened in the UK, or not the majority of people went the other way. But I think the Brexit was a precursor of what happened in America in the 2016 election. And it has a common underlying reason. And the common underlying reason is that people felt left out. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have to reinvent globalization as well. Because we have considered people understand by themselves that globalization is good. Globalization is good, but not for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure that those for whom it's not good, that they are carried with us, that they get a perspective, and not just kind of, they are not important, fly over states or whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think was the underlying reason for Brexit, for the election 2016, and also for this right wing parties in Europe. And that's why I think the president here is completely right by saying we have to reinvent foreign policies, trade policies, also with a view on what is good for the middle class, and not only what is good for the global companies. Because if we lose the middle class to these kind of populists, I think the global companies won't thrive either in the future.
You mentioned globalization, which goes a little bit against the grain of individualism from an American perspective, in terms of my freedoms are endangered, so I'm going to be ruled by some foreign government. I think the perhaps misunderstanding here is that globalization does not necessarily equal the surrender of individual liberties? How can we explain that to those who are, I would say, almost right-leaning populists, if you will, that they are not threatened?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is, if you want to trade with others, you cannot assume that they always follow your rules. Fair. There have to be common rules. And these common rules have to be agreed upon somewhere. There need to be some forum where you agree on them. And somebody has to implement them and also has to make sure that they are properly implemented. Because that's what we actually have with China, that we think some of the rules to which they agreed to, they are not really adhering to. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't speak against the rules, that only speaks against we need more enforcement. Mm-hmm. But that means, again, we need stronger international organizations. But if you at the same time complain about others not following the rules and then you dismantle those organizations who are actually there to make sure that the rules are followed, then there is a little bit of, there is some logical missing in that approach. So that's what we say. We actually need a very strong World Trade Organization. We want, for example, the Trump administration refused to appoint litigators, which meant the whole arbitration process in the WTO came to a standstill, which would have been so useful to hold China accountable. And then they thought we can hold them accountable on a bilateral basis. But that didn't help. Ask the farmers in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So we need strong international organizations, especially because we think that some actors do not act in good faith. So you have to strengthen them and not to dismantle them. And then once, I mean, it's the same with rules. I mean, I always find this argument, for example, with masking up, so crazy. I mean, wearing a mask does not infringe on your liberty. You stop at a red light. Why do you stop at a red light? Because it's dangerous to cross the crossing when it's on a red light. But you do it because you have learned if you don't do it, might be dangerous. And not only because you might be fined. You think you do it because it might be dangerous. And that's the same with masking. And that's the same with these rules on an international level. You have only liberty when you have law and order. Mm-hmm. And law and order means that you have to follow the rules that are put in the books to make life a little bit more safe and a little bit more predictable for most of the people. And that's what it's all about, I think. And this liberty is really not well understood if it means I can do what I like. I mean, these people who are the loudest in favor of law and order, they do not want their neighbor or whoever else do what they like, because that would infringe on their liberty at the end of the day. And so, but at the moment it's a bit difficult to get this into the heads of these people.
Yeah, it's a huge communications challenge. Speaking of masks, I know that a lot of people in our audience travel to Germany, have family in Germany, enjoy going to Germany. What is the travel situation like now for travel restrictions for people to visit Germany for work, business, family, tourists?
So if you are vaccinated fully and 2 weeks since the last shot, or if you are recovered from COVID and have an appropriate certificate from your doctor, then you can travel to Germany without any further restrictions. The airline with which you travel, they might require a test from the last 48 or 72 hours. But that's the airline, not our government. Our government only wants to make sure that you are vaccinated or you have recovered. The test is the airline business. And if you're neither recovered nor have a vaccination, then you need a test to travel. Then you need, also for us, not only for the airline, but also for us. And then you might have to quarantine in Germany for a while, for 8 days of. But in general, as now 70% of Americans almost are vaccinated, they can travel without any restriction. Now, the opposite is much more difficult. The United States is not opening up for Europe. And we are in a worse situation than if you come from Mexico or Latin American states or many other states. Even if you are vaccinated and even if you are tested, you can only come into the United States with the so-called National Interest Exemption Waiver. And that's only, you only get that if you are a business person who runs a business that is of national interest or very important, lots of jobs depending on it. And then there are some other exceptions like teachers and students and humanitarian cases who want to go in treatment or so. But and that is actually something that really annoys us at the moment, that it's not reciprocal. And it puts a certain advantage to Americans because the economies are now really on both sides of the Atlantic will start boosting, already boosting to a certain extent. And American businessmen can travel to Europe and take advantage of that. But European businessmen cannot come to America to take advantage of the boost here. And another tragic situation is we have so many Germans living here in the United States, running German companies on behalf of their companies. If they go back to Germany now for visiting their parents or simply for consulting with the owners or the management, they cannot be sure that they can come back because they can apply for this national interest exemption waiver only when they are already in Germany. The likelihood of getting it is at the best 50-50.
How long has this rule been in effect?
I mean, that rule has been in effect since the first presidential proclamation in April 2020, has been reinforced again, even in the Biden administration in March 21, has been slightly, but only slightly, kind of softened lately. So a couple of more businesses are now eligible to receive this national interest exception waivers, not exemption, exception waivers. Okay. And the problem is, in order to get that waiver, you have to get hold of American consular officers in one of the American consulates or embassies in Europe, which is sometimes not easy because they are closed.
This is incredibly fascinating because it seems that the United States administration understands on a broad perspective, macro perspective, that COVID is a dangerous virus, the SARS virus. Yet we seem to have an internal battle between those who are willingly getting vaccinated and believe that the vaccination actually is a, I would say, social benefit versus the stark opposite camp that vehemently objects to the vaccination and to masking up. So from a global perspective, we understand. From an internal perspective, we are at war, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, but what annoys us in particular is also that even those who understand the necessity of masking and understand the danger of the COVID treat us, Europeans, in a different way than other countries where the situation is worse. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine that if you're a European businessman who want to come to America and you don't get this waiver because your business isn't important enough or whatever, if you travel to Mexico first and stay 2 weeks in Mexico or to Dominican Republic and have 2 weeks of holidays in Dominican Republic, you can then travel to America no problem. Can you tell me what the logic is of that?
There really isn't any.
Yeah, I had no idea.
I didn't either.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm willingly talking about it because your audience should know that, especially those who are Germans living here and think they can now easily go back to Germany, to make sure that they have no problem to come back. If they have a green card, of course they come back. If they are American citizens as well, no problem. But if they are neither of that, then I would think twice before I travel to Germany now if I want to come back in the near future.
Does Germany have a similar rule as Austria, the 3G rule, the geimpft, getestet oder genesen, I think is the rule. So basically vaccinated, recovered or tested. That would be the loose translation of this.
I mean the point from coming here to Germany is exactly the 3G rule, and that's many people traveling already. We know that Americans on holidays, which that's why we opened up. I mean, to be honest, the German government was not so happy when the European Union decided to open up in June for Americans. Not because we don't like Americans, but we think we have enough problems at the moment with our variants and our COVID situation that we do not want to have on top all this issue with travelers. But those countries in Europe who depend almost to entirely in their economies on tourism, Greece, Spain, Italy, others, they were pressing the European Union of opening up for Americans, Ireland. And and in order to keep Europe together, we had to give in to a certain extent and compromise on that. Because, as I said in the very beginning, we have decided now we don't do anything anymore that is not in the European spirit. And if these countries depend so heavily on American tourists, not only American, but tourists also from other countries within the EU and everywhere else, then we understand that, and then we are prepared to compromise on that. That's why Europe is open now for Americans. And we actually, there was a discussion whether we do that only on the basis of reciprocity. But we knew that the Americans will not do that, so that then we had to give up even this idea of reciprocity. But I know last Thursday, I think it was, last week when Chancellor Merkel was in Washington, it came up and she mentioned it, and I think President Biden understood it and is kind of trying to see how he can compromise without giving up the travel restriction as such at the moment, because I think he has put his political stakes in the fact that he wants to combat the pandemic before anything else, and to get in additional problems from travelers, even if they are vaccinated. But you know, you always have a certain amount of virus coming, even with vaccinated people. I think that's simply that what he doesn't want at the moment. So there we are.
One last question regarding the virus. We see the variants coming up, particularly now the Delta virus, the Delta variant rising in the US. I believe also the cases are on an increase in Germany. Yeah. And I understand you're not a medical professional, but I'm just asking perhaps your educated perspective on this. How do you think this is going to unfold, and how is Germany going to address that on an individual and global perspective?
Now, the global perspective, we are one of the leading nations in this COVAX initiative, together with the United States. But even there is a bit of a difference. We donated vaccines to COVAX, even at a time when we didn't have enough vaccines for satisfying the demand of our own population. The United States is only giving money. And then COVAX can look where they get the vaccine and how they get it out of the country of production, because America has only recently started to allowing exporting vaccines. So, I mean, giving $2 billion and not knowing where to purchase the vaccine with this money was not too helpful, while we gave a couple of million doses to COVAX to satisfy the most immediate needs in some countries. Now that'll work out over time, and I think by next year we'll have a very good supply of vaccines for the COVAX initiative all over the world. But even there, we saw there is still a bit of an America first attitude, even in this administration, when it comes to vaccine distribution for the poorer countries. Now they start changing, because now there is a surplus of vaccine in the United States. But we already gave the vaccine away when we had a lack of vaccine to satisfy the demand of our populations. Yeah, I think we are now hitting the same kind of glass ceiling that America hits with the readiness to get vaccinated. We probably will learn from America what they all do to try to overcome that. It will never be 100%. I mean, if we get to 80% would be very good. I mean, before the variants, 70% was a threshold, but I think the scientists are now more or less united in thinking with these variants we need a higher percentage. And we try, and if not, we'll simply have to hope that we will not have too many outbreaks. The numbers are rising in Germany again, like in the United States, like everywhere. The number of severely ill people is not so much rising because now it's more the young people who get sick. But the variants are much more virulent to attack the human body. So that's why still lots of young people get sick. And we can only hope that every person who gets sick now is an appeal to all his friends, family, to say, we have to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. That's our only hope. And we are not too optimistic that this is going away soon if there is this hesitancy and still this ideological fight about vaccination, yes or no. And whether or not we go back in some kind of lockdowns and mask requirements and in the winter, that might be possible, but of course politically very, very difficult to implement.
I presume that the German government has a long-term plan as to what the relations with the U.S. should ideally look like, and of course we cannot sidestep COVID, so I'm sure the plans were adjusted to some measure. Can you give us some insight what the next number of years look like in terms of German-American relations?
You know, that's a very easy question to answer.
good.
Because Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Biden just issued a Washington Declaration at the 15th at their meeting, in which they laid out their main points of cooperation for the coming month and years. So that's very easy to answer because I just have to, I'm not reading it out, that's too boring, but just to mention the four or five main points that is actually written in this Washington Declaration, and everybody can look it up, mm-hmm. the internet nowadays. So there are 5 points. The first is a shared commitment to democratic principles, values and institutions. The second is defending an open world. That means open markets, open trade, but also open societies. Then the third is we are committed to a whole, free and Europe at peace. So that is for us very reassuring that the United States is reissuing their guarantee under the NATO agreement. Then the fourth is what I mentioned before, that Germany and the EU and United States want to work on rules, norms and standards that channel towards freedom rather than repression, for example, when it comes to rules on the internet, cyberspace and so on. And the last is the lead in the development of global solutions to shared challenges. That includes climate crisis, that includes energy policy, resilience against pandemics. So these are the 5 points that they agreed upon and that they issued this Washington Declaration. And on the climate and energy side, they, on top of it, issued a common climate action plan that is geared towards fulfilling all the climate accord requirements and strengthening them and to go towards the transformational energy solutions and to support energy transition in emerging economies. Mm-hmm. So that was a real deliverable for this summit. it's not just they met and had a nice talk. It's something really now upon which the governments can work, and I'm sure our European partners can buy into this altogether. So that is now a new basis that has been set, and that is going to be Ms. Merkel's legacy in transatlantic relations for the next month or years to come.
Those are incredibly big headlines, incredibly big points that are going to inevitably hinge on collaboration and perhaps a little less me first, but us together. What's the probability of actually accomplishing that within a reasonable time frame?
I mean, many of these points are not kind of new. We had that before. I mean, weren't we always committed to democratic principles and values? Mm-hmm. That's what our Western community of nations is based upon. The same is defending Europe together. The NATO is there for 75 years. So they are not reinventing the wheel. Mm-hmm. It's simply to reassuring that this, what we were working on before, and that has worked very well because we had peace, we had stability, we had progress, we had growth, that we want to continue again. And the last EU-US summit where President Biden was in Europe and met with the EU leaders and the NATO leaders, they issued similar declarations. So we all work now on the same kind of workbook. And we already noticed that the American administration on all departments are really committed to working on that. You can see that when they consult with you, before they do something, they consult with you, or at least they inform you early so that you can adapt your own position to it. That's already a difference to what happened before. Mm-hmm. And then there are things where they ask us for advice because they think we have probably in certain aspects we are a little bit further advanced. For example, when it comes to greening the grid and some green energy issues. So there is now a real commitment of the US administration to work with European and other partners again in fulfilling all these, as you said, big, big headlines and big, big goals. It's not just words on paper anymore.
And they answer their phones before 11 o'clock.
I hope so. No, the most important thing is that there are not every morning at 6 o'clock unpleasant surprises when you open up your Twitter account. That's already a big, big difference to what used to be before.
That is very true. Consul General, we are coming up to 1 hour. I know your time is limited. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your patience. I know I'm always tempted to answer to short questions, give very long answers. So
that is, from a podcasting perspective, the perfect mix. Okay.
So,
Aaron, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, that was once again an episode of Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute, this time with Consul General Wolfgang Mössinger, currently stationed in Chicago. If you do have any questions, future suggestions, of course, please do email us at podcast@gaimn.org. And within the next couple of episodes, we'll also catch you up on events. And until then, you can find all the events on our website at gaimn.org. This is Günther signing off. Thank you so much for being with us. Until next time, tschüss.